I'll talk about the context for higher education and community engagement just very briefly. And what I've done, this is actually an action research project with four African universities. And what I've done is I've used the findings from that and just played with it, really, to see how a lifelong learning framework, how those findings actually produce the kind of lifelong learning that the Jacques Delors pillars of 1996, learning to do, learning to be, learning to know, and learning to live together, and how they could be expanded to embrace a more modern context and also an African perspective. So the research was not to try and find out if the outreach project, the community engagement project, was going to meet those needs. But after the project had been done, I then decided to see whether there was some connection. I'll then talk about community engagement in African contexts, and then move on to the university and Lesotho itself, and then just introduce the project, and then show how I felt the findings had responded or not to the lifelong learning pillars. So a very brief context. There is generally, globally, a revival of interest in the third mission of universities, the community service mission. But primarily this has come from the North, Europe, Australia, and America. But after decades of underfunding in Africa, there is now a revival of interest generally in funding African higher education, and a much stronger focus on the need for African universities to respond to national development needs, and particularly the Millennium Development Goals. That's been the hook on which the coat of higher education is now hanging. And therefore, in Africa as well, there is now quite an evolving interest in community engagement, but drawing on the original mission of community service. I'm not going to talk about how that transition has moved, but there is now quite a shift from community service, which is a fairly top-down philanthropic approach, to the notion of community engagement, which is far more consultative, or that's the idea anyway. Now, lifelong learning has many interpretations, and the Delors report from 1996 now seems very old compared with the conversations that have been happening since. But the Delors report was meant to have universalist ideas about what learning was about. And as I've said, it was learning to know, learning to do, learning to be, and learning to live together. And Maria Torres in 2003, who is very much a Spanish, South Latin American contributor, says that in the modern age, there is really a need for a fifth pillar, which is about learning to change, learning to proactively direct change in this rapidly changing world. And a guy called Mbigi in 2005 specifically looked at those four pillars and tried to insert an African perspective or an African interpretation of those four pillars. So what I'm trying to do is to create a particular framework around those three aspects, the law pillars, the Torres introduction, and the Mbigi interpretation. And it's going to be very brief, and it could take a whole day or a book even to talk about these issues, but I'll try and do it in a couple of minutes. So there is no one African perspective, and there is no one European perspective, there is no one worldview that particular cultures can say this is now a pure version of where our culture is coming from. But there are certain tendencies that define how different cultures perceive the world and how they interact with the world. And one of them, the clearest differences really between the South or African perspectives and some of the Western perspectives is this notion of the collective and how we relate to each other in terms of our sense of identity. And in Africa, it is much more focused on the notion of we rather than I. I'm constantly being criticized by my colleagues in Lesotho for talking about I'm doing this or I will do that. They say, no, it's we. The sense of who we are and how we are interconnected with each other is much stronger in Africa than it is in the West. And there are many proverbs that explain that. Like, for example, a person is a person through other persons. It takes a village to raise a child. A child is one person's only in the womb. And also there is a much stronger spiritual connection. The concept of ancestors and how they influence the present, and the notion of how we are working towards a future of children yet to be born, that connection between the living, the dead, and the yet to be born is much stronger in African contexts. And many African societies, people still pray to their ancestors if they are in times of trouble or if they are concerned within the present. And that's still very strong. So Mbidi tried to, taking on board some of those issues, he tried to interpret how the four pillars could be interpreted. The other aspect of learning in African context, the traditional lifelong learning, was very much a practical, functional basis. And so some of these things reflect that as well. So learning to know is not just about learning to know in the present, learning to know something. It's about the capacity to reflect on your experiences and where you've come from. Learning to do follows very much a traditional apprenticeship type model of learning, which is about mimicking other people, copying from other people, learning from others. Sitting by Nelly is the English phrase. Learning to live together is strongly embedded in the sense of phrases like Ubuntu, Boto, all these African words that are not easily translatable, but are to do with respecting others in order to ensure that they will respect you, and recognizing that we are interdependent and we are interconnected. Learning to be, Mbeki's interpretation was, this is about developing the whole person, not just creating an identity for yourself, but creating the multiple intelligences of a person, looking at how they are as a fully rounded person. And we can, you know, discuss these forever about how different they are or how similar they are to the West, but nevertheless, there is an African focus on this. And Torrey's notion of learning to change is about recognizing past and future contexts for lifelong learning, and to try and proactively direct change for human well-being and development as a national and human aspiration. So what I now tried to do was to see how those concepts of lifelong learning were reflected on by the people that we interviewed. I didn't ask them to comment on whether they were learning to change or whether they were learning to do. Their questions were, it wasn't me even asking them, it was the researchers. Their questions were simply, what were the benefits of your learning? What were the challenges? What were the prospects? And what I've now done is tried to fit those responses into those different categories. Now, I've briefly already introduced this. The third mission of community service, now focusing on community engagement, it ranges from volunteering as an individual activity to volunteering as a community requirement, particularly in South Africa, which where they have a white paper on higher education which specifically requires students to undergo a service learning component of community activities. And this means that they have to reflect on their own learning, and they are assessed on their own reflection of that learning. And clearly in South Africa, this was to try and develop more responsible citizenship as a reaction to the apartheid situation in the past, to try and create closer links between the different cultures living there. But also, community engagement is being seen very much as a means of responding to national development needs. The public engagement, making universities relevant to the development needs of different countries and their requirements. Lesotho is in the bottom 10% of countries in the world. It has a very low life expectancy, primarily because it is one of the countries with the highest HIV/AIDS prevalences. And it is still very much a rural community. More than 60% of the community is still engaged in subsistence farming. And the other 40% are not all employed, but there is a high, you can't identify an unemployment rate specifically, because so many people are simply engaged in subsistence farming. And there are many parts of the country which don't have electricity or piped water or sanitation, even around our university. While our university has flush toilets, the villages around us don't, because the plumbing system just isn't there. So it is a poor country, an economically poor country anyway. The university, National University of Lesotho, is the only government university. There is a private technology university, Lim Kok Wing, which has plonked itself in many African countries, including Botswana. There is a teacher training college that's government funded, and there are some small vocational colleges. But essentially, the university is the only, the national university is the only university. And when you consider that only 3 to 5% of the population in Africa attends universities, Lesotho has a student population of something like 12,000 in a population of about 2 million. So we're talking about a very small percentage that actually go to university. Nevertheless, the mission statement of NUL includes a commitment to community service and lifelong learning. The project, we called it ITMUR. It stands for Implementing the Third Mission of Universities in Africa. It involved four universities, one from Botswana, one from Malawi, and the University of Calabar in Nigeria, with the National University as the lead university. And its aim was to explore how the third mission could contribute to the MDGs and how each partner university can enhance its community service mission for community engagement. So that was the focus of the research. We started with an initial audit of existing activities, and then each university identified two case studies to explore those research questions in more detail. In Lesotho, we had one case study which was called Mahoma Temeng, translated as educating to feed ourselves. It was in a very remote mountain region, about 5.5 hours drive from the university, 6 hours drive from the main capital city. And it was a self-help organization where people were trying to become self-sufficient as a means of helping to support orphans and vulnerable children. The second project, and the first project was actually initiated by a member of staff as an individual project, and we took it on board as a multidisciplinary project to try and see how we could support it in a more multidisciplinary way. The Roma Valley Pensioner Project was just the brainchild of an individual who had done some research into pensioners in Lesotho. Lesotho is unusual in that it is one of the few least developed countries that provides a pension. It is a monthly pension of about £30, €30 a month, and the pensioners come along once a month to the local post office and they collect it. But they hang around for about 2 hours before the pension actually arrives. They start to arrive at about 8:30 in the morning, they bring things to eat, it becomes a social gathering, and then about 10:30, the pension van comes, the money van comes, and they line up and start collecting their pension. And it was during those 2 hours that we felt that maybe there was an opportunity for providing some kind of educational input. And we did a needs analysis, and they were quite interested in having a range of projects that they would listen to. So the data collection methods were primarily qualitative. Well, they were entirely qualitative, in fact. We had observation. We did observations, we did interviews, focus group interviews. They were mostly done in the local language of Sesotho and then were translated into English. And then we, as a project, compared these findings across the different universities. This is, we also involved students. It wasn't just adults. We involved members of the community as educational providers. We also involved students, and we also provided our own input as lecturers. This was a student nurse from the university taking blood pressure readings from the local pensioners. And the little green canopy up there was just a kind of symbolic place for people to realize something was going to happen. This was all done outside, outside the post office. This one was a lecturer from the agriculture faculty. and he was demonstrating how to build what is called a keyhole garden. And this garden eventually builds up, it's layered with various levels of bricks, and the idea is that people who have limited mobility and who can't bend, they can still grow and plant vegetables. I don't have a final picture here, but it's quite an interesting garden when you see it in its final state. This, again, is the pensioners' project again. We also contacted the local police station, which was not far away, and he came to do a crime prevention talk. We also have to recognize that African societies are traditionally oral societies, and listening in this way is a very, it's not an unusual way of learning, because community meeting places in villages and things, most of the news is spread through this kind of speaking to an audience. So it's not an unusual way for people to learn, and people memorize things very quickly as a result of this kind of learning. This other project was the Mahoma Temeng project, way up in the mountains. This was the building that we used. It had no electricity, no heating, no lighting. And this is the mountain, surrounding mountain area. Absolutely idyllic, beautiful place to be, but really very remote. And as you can see, also very high up and therefore also very cold. Lesotho is unusual in Africa in that we have very, very cold winters. And they were doing workshops on how to generate income, how to make small businesses work more effectively, and also how to look after their orphan children. So the findings. As I said, we asked them just to say what they'd learned, what they'd gained from it. Learning to know was easy enough. They learned some practical things about how to build keyhole gardens, about health, nutrition, general range of things. But they also, we interviewed staff, students, and community members. And also included in learning to know was learning to know about each other a bit more. And both the staff and students said they'd learnt a little bit more about what were the elderly's needs and about who they were as people. Learning to do, again, very obvious, how to start micro-businesses, how to produce food, how to improve health, how to protect themselves from crime. So learning to know and learning to do was fairly obvious. But I thought what was rather interesting was when they started talking about other things, and the students said they learnt that there was a spirit of oneness within the university departments, and they were saying that the university departments were working together, where they were not in competition with each other. And these were things that the students just highlighted as something that was quite significant and interesting to them. And the police also, they realised that it was, the police cannot combat crime in isolation, they needed to work with universities and other groups. They realised that this was a real platform for reaching out to different people. Connecting to organisations, working together, learning from each other. One of the lecturers said she'd learned from one of the adult educators about the different techniques of talking to adults, which would be different from talking to younger students. So they learned a range of things, not just about learning practical activities. These are things they spontaneously came up with in terms of learning. And learning to be, again, one of the students said, I've learned that whether one is young or old, he or she is still a person. So learning about who we are as individuals and how we interrelate with each other. And many of them talked about becoming more self-sufficient, having a greater sense of purpose. These were very small pilot-scale projects that lasted about 6 months, were small workshops, nothing very special, really. And then learning to change. Some of the students who were involved with the pensioners, they were counselling students, and what they did is sat down with the pensioners to talk to them about their problems and what issues and difficulties they were having. And many of them talked about the difficulties they were having with bringing up grandchildren. Because of the HIV/AIDS problem, many of the parents have died, and the pensioners, the grandparents, are quite often the main providers for households, and many of them naturally have difficulty with managing young children, a new generation, a new era, and in an era that they have played very little part in. And so the students would give them advice and support about how they could manage the children. And again, spontaneously, one of the students said, "We talked with the old woman about different approaches to this problem, and she reported that since we talked to her, her daughter has changed her behaviour." So the following month, things had happened, things had been changing. The police said many villages have formed crime prevention committees. As a result, crime is reduced. And many of the community beneficiaries said, "We've started selling small items and have increased our monthly income and able to take more responsibility for our families." So there were definite indications of learning to change. However, it wasn't all straightforward. There were many, many challenges. In terms of learning to know, there was very limited time to acquire better knowledge of how to help. This was a very small-scale project. In terms of learning to do, there were limited opportunities for follow-up and continuity, and it was clear that if these people were to, everybody, people being the community, the researchers, the students, the members of staff, if everybody was going to gain from this, it needed to be a more long-term activity. And the other tension that I think every community worker knows, the tension between creating a dependency syndrome because you are going in there to assist a community and creating a self-sufficiency situation whereby the university is merely a facilitator, that, you know, any parent will realize that you have to let your child grow up in order for it to go away. Communities and community needs have the same needs. So there was a strong tension. Once we'd gone in there, the community immediately decided that we should be there to provide more resources. They wanted money from us. There were all sorts of expectations that we as a university should be doing and giving to the community. And it was hard to make them realize that we were there really to facilitate their own growth and their own development rather than to become parents. Other challenges, learning to live together. There was a need for more collaborative involvement. And the most obvious one, learning to change. One of the pensioners said, "We never thought of implementing any of the things that you were saying. We just listened and, you know, we took it on board, but we didn't realize that we were supposed to do something about it." So there is a need for follow-up to promote ongoing learning. So finally, no surprises here really. There is huge potential for community engagement as an activity to promote all those lifelong learning pillars. The emphasis is very much on living and working together, nurturing a sense of interdependence rather than dependence, and independence still relates to interdependence. And the need for sustained engagement in order to reduce that dependency, and the need for mutual listening and awareness creation. One of the comments from, or several comments from university staff was, "This was different from the way we normally engage with communities. Normally we go out and tell communities what to do, but this one was based on a needs analysis and listening to what the community wanted." And the need to create an understanding that the university is a facilitator rather than the sole resource for learning. What we did was engage a number of other organizations to help create those learning opportunities.
Thanks, Julia. It was really interesting. I suppose you've sort of raised within the challenges that you listed, and just as you're saying, Steve, that there is a challenge from this idea of lifelong learning and engagement, and how you shift to community development, say, and that idea of learning to change, as Tora's noted the second bit, it's about not just individual change, about that collective change. And just as similar to personal experience or experience of students that we work with, that they expect people to do things for them, you know, and this idea of just, you know, when our students go on placement, we're asking them to engage and facilitate and challenge the students to take, the communities to take on whatever it is they want to take on. But there's a real barrier, and I don't think we've got an easy answer yet. It's not really, I don't have an easy answer, but I just wanted to say it's, you know, while you're talking about Africa, same in Glasgow or surrounding areas, and I'm sure in England and lots of other places.
Yes, it's no different from my experiences of 13 years as a community worker in inner city areas of Birmingham. All the same issues are there. The only difference really is the degree to which we're dealing with very poor communities. The level of poverty is obviously much higher than it would be in a country like here. But also, as a result, a little bit of input goes a very long way as a result. You know, a couple of workshops on how to manage your businesses a bit better, and there they are, immediately selling cakes and things in a much more... they get rewards very quickly as a result of a very small amount of input from us or anyone else. I think you need that as well.
Wonderful acoustics in this room. I was going to ask, what's the next step, really? I mean, how is this going to be rolled out on a larger scale?
That's a big question mark. Out of the four universities that we were involved in, I think Dharma up there, who comes from the University of Botswana, Botswana is much more involved in creating a long-term community engagement. It has a much more strategic role within the university. The key issue here was that there needs to be a university strategic plan, and there isn't in Lesotho. The university has been through some rather trying times lately with no vice chancellor in place for almost 2 years. So institutional decision making has been somewhat limited. The University of Malawi, I think there were general commitments from the people involved in the projects to carry on with those projects. The University of Calabar was starting from a very low base again, but there was a vice chancellor's commitment that this is something that we could try and develop on a wider basis. But really, there needs to be an institutional strategy to make this work. In the same way as the widening participation story, for years we did widening participation from one department with very little impact on the rest of the university, and it took funding from the funding councils to make the university develop strategic policies before it could be embedded. And one of our policy recommendations is to take exactly that approach, to tell governments to ask the universities to identify a strategic plan for which there would be ring-fenced funding. Now, that's something not commonly done in some of these countries. So this is a very much a new idea for them, but it was a key policy recommendation from us.
That's a real... You couldn't get better sign of success than that, really. Have you got a VC yet?
We have now, yes.
Okay, well, I won't put my application in. Okay, do we have any other questions?
I don't know how you selected the respondents, but my interest is in finding out how you kept away maybe the opinions or the influence of the opinion leaders or gatekeepers.
All right, yes. How we kept away or how we kept awake? Okay. Yes. 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 Yeah. No, what we did, we first of all got permission from the community councils and the chiefs to enable us to work with those communities. But the interviews were directly from the community members. I think there was a community councillor who was one interviewee in one of the areas, but the pensioners, for instance, they were sitting outside the post office, so we just interviewed them outside the post office. So we got them directly from the members themselves, and also from the people who took part in providing, the police officer we interviewed, the lecturer we interviewed, and the students. So those who took part were all interviewed. But we didn't have the problem with gatekeepers in the same way that one would normally expect, because we just got permission to work with the communities. And they all signed, they all agreed that they signed a consent form, all that kind of stuff. So we got ethical, we covered the ethical issues, but we were talking directly to the community members themselves, not the gatekeepers in this case.
Hello. Oh, yes, it is. Hello. Okay. Actually, I think we're just about out of time. Yeah. And I thank you very much, Julia, for that really, really interesting paper. And I wish you well with taking things forward with that agenda.
Thank you.
So thanks very much.
Thank you.
We'll just give Amy a few seconds to set up.
Click on that, yeah? Okay,
half an hour on the
plenty
clock.
Plenty of time.
Off you go.
Thank you. Okay, before I get started, I just want to firstly say thank you to the lovely people from FACE and Escalate that have made it possible for me to be here at this conference. This is the first time I've done something like this, so I've learnt loads. So thank you very much for that opportunity. Plenty for me to think about when I go back to my day job. So I'm going to be just introduce myself. My name's Amy. I'm an outreach activities officer at the University of Sheffield, and I've worked there for about 18 months now. My chief responsibility is working on an outreach to medicine scheme that works with young people and their families in communities local to Sheffield and the surrounding regions. So I want to sort of talk about the scheme today as a model for one way in which universities can work with local and regional communities. So what I'm going to be looking at are these key themes. Just briefly touch on the politics, talk you through some case studies from some students that have been through the scheme with us, and just to really highlight some of the themes that we see again and again on the scheme. Talk about the model, which incorporates how we target local communities and the structure of the programme, and then just share with you some reflections on the scheme, what makes it successful and what we think sort of might happen in the future for us. So this is our little logo. It stands for Sheffield's Outreach and Access to Medicine Scheme, but we know it as SOAMS. It's developed a bit of an identity of its own as such. Established in 2001, so it's been going for a number of years, even though I've only worked on the scheme for 18 months now. So I can hopefully build on the successes for the future. The broad aim of the scheme is to make a career in medicine a possibility for students from backgrounds underrepresented in higher education and the medical profession. So fairly common sort of aim there for outreach schemes. Just to briefly mention the political situation, I know we've spoken a bit about social mobility yesterday, and I'm sure you're all aware about the political agenda at the moment with regard to access to the professions being key. SOAMS ties in with those national agendas. One of the main, well, an important report was Alan Milburn's Access the Professions Report of 2009, and he spoke of this not for the likes of me idea, which we discussed a bit yesterday as well, and we see that very much from the students that we work with on the scheme. We were also mentioned in an offer report of 2010 as a case study for one way that highly selective universities can widen access, and that was Martin Harris that produced that report in 2010. So we tie in with those national agendas, but we do very much have a local focus, and that links in with the university's charter going back 100 years when the university was created for the people of Sheffield. So that's what the scheme ties in with. So we work on those two different levels, really. So just moving on to the case studies. I've started gathering a few case studies because they do illustrate quite well what the scheme aims to achieve and how it goes about doing that. I've chosen two case studies to just share some of the findings with you and the key themes that came out of those. So we're looking at student A here. She's a female student, went to a school in Sheffield with a low progression rate to higher education. Parents did not attend university themselves, and she's currently studying medicine at Sheffield University and works as an ambassador on our scheme for us. So she comes back and she participates in the sessions and works with other young people. Student B, similarly, similarly went to a school with a low progression rate for GCSEs, but through hard work managed to get a place at a school with higher achieving school for A-levels. Neither of his parents attend university either. studies medicine at Sheffield currently and also works as ambassador for us. So see, these are some of the key themes we see emerging from the case studies. So firstly, students very clearly have before they come on the scheme with us, have a lack of awareness of higher education and medicine and also a lack of family knowledge. So we hear things like, I'd always heard of university, but at the time I didn't really understand what it was all about. I was extremely apprehensive about any career involving university, simply on the basis of my very little knowledge about university, coupled with the fears my parents had regarding the financial implications. So you can see clearly there that the young people we work with come from that family background. That's how we target them on the scheme. Their parents can't have been to university. But the scheme aims to work with the young people and also their families as well. We often see that the families are very supportive. They just don't know how to go about offering that support to get their children into university and onto a medicine degree. So we try and provide some of that support that's lacking there. Students lack confidence. This is a major issue for students from WP backgrounds. We see student A saying, I knew that in order to study medicine, I had to go to university, but I never thought I would actually get there. I was scared by the preconception that university was full of higher class students with backgrounds completely different to me, who I would never be able to integrate with. So this is sort of one of the perceived barriers that often gets in the way of students going on to study medicine from these backgrounds, and we work to challenge that throughout. One of the areas that we particularly see a lack of confidence being an issue is interview time when it comes to medical school interviews, so we have to try and offer additional support at that stage, and I'll talk a bit about that a bit later on. Sense of achievement, this is something that we aim to promote throughout the scheme. It's a selective scheme, so although we target through socioeconomic guidelines, we also look at academic achievement when students apply. So there is a real sense of achievement from the outset that they've done something good by getting onto the scheme, and that is a motivating factor throughout their time with us. So we see how did they feel when they got onto the scheme, ecstatic. I remember thinking what a great opportunity I've been given. I was very proud, as was my entire family. Okay, support from schools is vital for us, not only in terms of the support they offer the young people on the scheme, but also we work with them in the selection process. They're within the communities and they know they know better than us what the students are like, and they know what we're looking for in students for the scheme. So it's also very important if a student feels that a teacher believes in them, that is a big motivating factor for them as well. So. When I was in primary school, I was always told how good I was at science. One of my tutors at college had heard of the same scheme and encouraged me to apply. I think he was the first person to really believe in me, and this is a really important part of the scheme for us. We bring students into university, so exposure to the university environment is vital, not just the academic side of things, but also the student life side of things. So you can see walking onto the concourse, everything was so exciting. It was a very unique feeling standing in the middle of the student union as an insignificant little pupil in a sea of students rushing past in the daily life. It was very exciting and spurred me on to think more and more about medicine. So it shows it's that whole experience that's important. It's not just feeling like they're clever enough to go to university. It's seeing that university is full of other young people just like them, really, and that they can get there if they want to. Final thing from the case studies is that the students that have been through the scheme with us now see themselves very clearly as role models. Because we've been going for nearly 10 years now, we've got a number of students who have been through the scheme and are at the university studying and are working in the medical profession. And the benefit of having young people like that now that we can still work with is fantastic. They not only can go back into their own communities and act as role models. Here we see students gone back into school to give support with the children in school there. We can see that students work as mentors for us. E-mentoring is a big part of the programme, and so students on SOMES get paired with a medical student and they get to communicate with them through Bright Journal's website, and that's really valuable. So they're acting as role models within the scheme, they're acting as role models within the medical profession as well. This one particular student has gone on to represent WP on a sort of national level within the medical school and taken part in various different activities. So you can see that the students are role models within their communities, within the university, and within the medical profession as well. And that's fantastic for us. So just to reflect on what issues have been raised there, SOMES aims to support young people in overcoming barriers, and you can see some of those barriers are real in terms of university application process, but some of them are also their own barriers, the perceived barriers, that they feel that it's not for them. So we work to overcome all those barriers on Soames. The role model aspect of things is vital to the success of the scheme. And just one question for me really is there anything more that we can be doing on the scheme with regard to those role models? We use them on our sessions, but is there other ways that we can use them? And that's something I'm going to be thinking about going forward. So now I just want to talk you briefly through the model of how Soames works and the structure that it takes up. So targeting is a major part of Soames. And the way that we target, because it's a selective scheme, students need to apply for a place on the scheme. And we target through the communities through the school contacts, as I've mentioned. This is great for us because it means that we can get that support that the school offers in terms of the students getting time out of their lessons. The school knows that the students are on Soames and might need some extra support with regard to that. Once they've applied to the scheme, we then communicate directly with the families and the students themselves. So we're building up our own networks within communities and the region, sort of regionally and locally to Sheffield. And they are strong networks. We get to know the families and the students that have been with us for the full duration of the scheme. The risk factor for us there is that if we do lose school contacts, then that's a lot of support and that we lose with that. So we have to work hard to hang on to those and make sure that we communicate regularly with the schools, and if a teacher is moving on, that we work out a new person that we can contact with. These are the guidelines we work with for students applying to Soames. So they need to be the first generation in their family to go on to higher education. They need to want to study locally, and they need to have some sort of personal circumstances that could limit their aspirations in some way. They also need to be good in science and maths. We also look at socioeconomic information like parental occupation and postcode, and sort of refer to all this information as a basket of indicators. We don't look at one thing in isolation, we take it all as a whole. It means that making decisions can become quite a lengthy process as to who we should let onto the scheme. And we're looking at what more information we should be including going forward in light of some of the changes that are coming in for universities. Is there any other information we should be asking students to give us when they apply? So students can apply for the scheme at the beginning of year 9 or at the beginning of year 12 for a place on the scheme. And you can see it works in two distinct phases. So big groups at year 9 and smaller groups for year 12 and 13. And they are quite different, the two phases of the scheme, and the sort of support that students need at each different point can vary. But the whole sort of overall aim of that structure is to raise awareness, aspiration and achievement. This is the way that phase one looks. There's quite a lot of information on there. I won't go through it all in detail, but you can see from the sort of colour coding that there's a range of different sessions. So some are general higher education skills development sessions, some have a medical focus, some have a science focus, because we don't want to, when we're working particularly at phase one, not all of the students will go on to study medicine, so we want to show them other opportunities in that field of science and other things that they can do at the university as well. So that's why we have those activities in there. And there's also elements of guidance and support. But alongside that, we're always at the end of the phone. We're sort of an advice line to an extent for students as well. Here's some photos of some of our events. So some of the more science events. And then there's some team building events and in our labs. And there's the celebration evening there at the bottom. So this is phase two of the programme. And you can see from the key at the top, there's a lot more support that's offered at phase two. That's because students at phase two are very focused on applying for medicine. So we need to offer them support that goes along with that. There's also elements of medical focus sessions. We also have the summer school, which is the most important event, summer between year 12 and year 13. And that's when students come and stay with us on the campus. And that's a range of different events that they take part in during that time. You can see along the side, there's always ongoing support and advice and guidance for students. We evaluate and track students throughout the scheme, so we keep sort of monitoring their how they're getting on and look for any issues. The e-mentoring part of the programme, which I spoke about, is very important, working with the current medical students. And then GI at the bottom stands for guaranteed interview, because all students on phase two of Soames get a guaranteed interview at the medical school, providing they get BBCC in their AS levels. So that is quite an important part of phase two of the scheme. Here's some photos from phase two. So you can see this is the summer school. We do quite focused sessions for clinical skills where they do ethics presentations. But then we also like to, you know, have fun, explore the social side of being at university. Getting our admissions team to dress up and take part in a murder mystery for us is all really important part of the programme. So that isn't a rigid programme. There is flexibility within that. So if we notice any trends or any particular areas that students need support with, we can change the programme and add new sessions into that. We also can offer tailored support. We're often, if you know there's some kind of crisis going on with a student, the students will contact us, and we can intervene at that individual level. So whilst we work with very large groups, we can have a very individualised approach if we need to. We're also able to spot trends over time and see if there's any variations in achievement or any issues that students are consistently having, and we can then offer support and introduce aspects to the programme. For example, the one-to-one sessions which we've introduced recently, which is just before they go for their medical school interview, we'll get them in to sit down with us and have a chat through any issues that they're having and run through a mock interview to just give them that extra support at a time when they need it. Key features of the programme, the guaranteed interview, is quite a motivating factor for students. Keeps them engaged and motivated. Again, the use of ambassador role models, we use them at all our events pretty much to run the medical side of things, bring those skills and experience, but also to act as role models. And they're very often working with young people from their communities on those events, so they'll see people, they'll be able to see people that, you know, come from where they come from, studying as medical students now. Which is really important. We also act as a sort of lobbying force within the university. So we are able to operate on this level of working with young people, but we also get involved with things like when it comes to results day, we'll go and act as advocates for our students in admissions meetings in terms of deciding who gets through onto the scheme, onto the medical degree. We're also working with the medical school to brief interviewers so that interviewers are aware of what they might see from a student from a WP background. So we can get involved in some of those politics as well. We've also been mentioned in the university's mission, vision, identity statement as an exemplar project for cultivating ambition. So we are embedded in the university's ideology as well. So that's sort of an additional part of the scheme that we're able to get involved with. So this is just some results from our destination studies to show where our students end up. In 2008, you can see we surveyed students over the telephone, which is when they're age 18, when they're leaving us on the scheme, and we find out where they've ended up. So we got an 87% response rate from the students we contacted, had 74% starting university, 15% deferring for a year, and then the other figures just going down sort of in FE with no plans and with doing other things, but you can see that those figures are sort of reflected in 2009 as well. So the conclusions are that SOMES is a robust model. It's been around for a number of years now, and as far as I know, it's going to be around for the foreseeable future, and it has demonstrated some success in driving the agenda forward, but it doesn't work in isolation. It's, you know, part of a bigger outreach programme at the university and a programme of public engagement that we've got. So it's just one strand of activity that we're doing, but it can demonstrate success. We've got, as I mentioned, ex-SOMES students that form their own networks and promote WP in various different areas, whether that's back in local and regional communities or whether it's in the medical profession. And this model can be applied to other outreach schemes. So at the university, we've got the ADOPT scheme as well, which takes a similar model but is focusing on dentistry. And we've got one about law as well. But it can work for more general aspiration raising schemes as well. And these are just the future considerations going forward. In terms of student finance and the changes that are coming in, how are we going to deal with that issue working with these students? Is that going to become a major issue for them and a major barrier to them going on to study medicine? Are we going to have to look to work more so with departments? At the moment, we're a separate department to the medical school, but we are linked to that department, but we're not sitting within it. So are we going to work more within the departments going forward? How are we going to look at our targeting? Do we need to think of getting more information in there when we're working with young people? Do we need to think about promoting Sheffield as a good choice? And up until now, we've been working with just generally raising aspirations and getting students to think about university in general, but are we going to have to think about getting students to Sheffield University in the future, as opposed to just general university? And how can we build on the work with role models going forward? So that's the end. Has anyone got any questions?
Thank you very much, Amy. Okay, do we have any questions? Great, Julia.
Thank you very much. Yes, thank you. I can see that all widening participation programmes are about attracting people to their local university, and it's never occurred to me that that should be an issue. But then when I saw your sentence saying the need to go to a local university, it just struck me that I just wonder whether you have relationships with other medical universities, because it isn't always a good idea for a student who has local problems to then go to their local university. And it struck me that whilst you're obviously now trying to think about promoting Sheffield as the good choice, and I can understand the marketing strategy for that, is there any opportunity to enable these students to go through that process, get all those the benefits of that programme, but linking up with other universities, or even pairing with another university somewhere else and saying, you know, can we do a swap arrangement so that students have a greater choice? Because it strikes me that there is an element of choice that's not allowed here for these particular students compared to any other student who doesn't have the same disadvantages.
Yeah, there's nothing formally in place with regard to that. And when we work with students on the scheme, that's one of the recruiting, you know, factors that we consider, but we would never enforce that in any way. We work with the students individually, and we, throughout the scheme, you know, we get them into the university, we get them working with our academics, we get them working with our students. A lot of them do want to consider studying locally anyway as a result of financial issues, or students from those backgrounds often feel insecure at the idea of moving away, so they want to stay within the family environment. So we don't find that it's a major issue that students feel pressured to go to Sheffield University, and we do get a number of students that will apply to other universities to study medicine as well as Sheffield, and will end up going to those other universities, and that's fine if that's what they feel is right for them. As in terms of having formalised agreements, we don't have anything in place at the moment. It's definitely been talked about. It's definitely something that people above me are considering going forward, whether it's actually put into place as a formal arrangement or not. That's quite a big issue at the moment, and universities are looking at, should we form regional sort of contacts that we could do that kind of thing with, because with some of the changes that the government are bringing in, we're going to have to demonstrate in our figures that we're getting more students from those backgrounds into our university. So if we've done work with a student for 5 years that then goes on to another university, that essentially doesn't add to those figures. And that's not why we're doing it, but if the government are saying that that's what they need to see from us, we need to think of ways that we can track those students and still demonstrate that impact through what we're doing. So we have Sheffield Hallam University, which is another university in Sheffield, and we don't have a formal arrangement, but we would, if we had a student that went through the scheme, didn't have the right grades, or decided that medicine wasn't for them, we may phone someone up at Hallam University and arrange for that student to go in and have a chat with them, have a tour, see what the facilities are like. And then they've then met someone within that university and can consider that applying there, and we would support that process as much as we can. So, yeah, it's an interesting idea, and it's definitely something that we're considering going forward, but how that will actually be implemented, we don't know yet.
It's very difficult because of the way in which things are set up with access agreements. As you say,
yeah,
you have
exactly
to report your outputs and your, and so on. I think certainly in our area, one of the things that we're doing is retaining the work that we've done with Aim Higher in terms of a tracking database for the southern region, which we're hoping will allow us to demonstrate impact across a range of universities, mm-hmm. so we don't get trapped into that. But at the moment, I have to say, it's falling on deaf ears a little bit, which is frustrating.
Mm-hmm.
Any more questions for Amy? Oh, great, I've got three. Do I have the only mic? Oh, no, you're up there. Okay. Sorry, go ahead, yes.
I have a better question about maths and physics. In Sweden, we see this gap growing larger and larger between the gymnasium and the higher education. You had mathematics and physics as one of the aspects to getting into your program, or trying to, or I don't know if I should call it program, but then you know what I mean.
Yeah.
So I wonder, does the level go down, and do you miss out a lot of students that could be very good doctors because of the issue with the physics and mathematics that they don't learn, their parents don't know how to learn, how to give them the education at home, like freckles and stuff that can be a bit of a trouble.
Yeah. Physics isn't something that students need to apply for medicine. So it's more chemistry that is the main subject. So we do have academic entry requirements for students onto the scheme. For example, if they're applying at phase one, we ask that they need to be in the top 10% of their year group, and they need to be able to achieve 5 A to C's at GCSE level, which is lower than what a standard entrant to a medical school would need going in. So we do make allowances for that fact that students are going to, from these backgrounds, aren't going to be necessarily going to the schools where they get the highest results, and we take that into account. We would always look at extenuating circumstances for a student as well. So we get teacher comments on an application form, and if a teacher can explain to us on that why the student isn't getting the grades that they think they're capable of, we will consider them that when getting them onto the scheme. We also need to be aware of the fact that medicine is incredibly competitive, and we still have to maintain some, you know, academic standards with regard to the department. So we also need to look at a student and consider, do they have the ability to, perhaps if we let them on in year nine, is the scheme going to give them that extra kick and that bit of motivation to work that little bit harder at school, and then to get the grades that they need to get into medicine? Or are we essentially raising their hopes for them to be crushed at a later stage? So there's so many things we need to think about when accepting a student onto the scheme. And with medicine, it's the academic side of things is very difficult, because at the moment there's no sort of, generally across the board, universities don't generally lower entry requirements for students. But again, it's something that is in the sort of conversation, and perhaps with regard to the financial situation, in terms of student finance, it may be that there's more pressure on universities to do that kind of thing, but again, it's still all in the pipeline at the moment, really.
Great, thank you. Another question? Yeah, okay. Thanks.
I haven't heard you mention conditions that are attached to the scheme. Are they in?
Sorry?
Conditions.
Conditions for?
That are attached to the scheme. Do you expect the students, for instance, who have benefited from the scheme to serve their community?
We don't put any conditions on them as such. There's, but like I spoke about in that, the students that have been through the scheme with us, we keep in good contact with them. They feel part. They identify with SOMES. They feel that they are SOMES students, and they feel, the majority of them feel, that they want to get involved in helping, well, working as ambassadors on our events and working in back in the communities, going back into schools, that kind of thing. So we don't say to them, if you've been through the scheme with us, you must come and work as an ambassador or anything like that. It's more their own choice. And through that, we get a good number of students that do participate in that side of things. So there's no sort of standard conditions that they have to fulfill or anything like that.
Okay, thank you. Any more? We've got time, I think, probably for one or two more. Yeah, just here, please.
Hiya, I'm just wondering, your basket of evidence for contextual data, is there any way that you can actually use the discussions that are going on just now, thinking about wider participation, thinking about social mobility, to actually use what you're doing in line with the evidence about the students' backgrounds and the, you know, the extra barriers that they've got? Because it's not just motivation, I think there's like huge kind of social barriers to actually guarantee, not just an interview, but guarantee places at university from students from those backgrounds. Mm-hmm. That is an argument here from a number of the students that said about years in particular for doing that. Is that something that you think you would be able to argue?
Yeah, I mean, guaranteed places, we've got, the scheme was established with 20 ring-fence places on the medicine degree for students from these backgrounds. We've recently worked with the medical school for them to say there isn't now a cap on those number of places. So if we work with 40 students in a year group and 40 of them apply to medicine, 40 of them get an offer, there's not going to be a cap on those places now. So that's something that we've been working closely with the medical school to agree. We do, outside of SOMES, I mean, SOMES is a small part of sort of the overall admissions process. We do support students in other ways. There's a medical outreach scheme that students run themselves. So there's various other things like that. There's also students that come from WP backgrounds get a flag on their application form as well. So when the admissions team see that form, they will know, you know, that students come from that background. And we're working, really, that's part of the lobbying thing that we're doing, to raise the awareness of people in the interview room, because they might sometimes see that flag and not always be aware fully of what that means. So we're planning to go into the medical school interviews and sort of sit down with them just 5 minutes at the beginning of the day and say, this is what, you know, this is where we're from, this is what you might see in an interview situation. So we are working to sort of break down those barriers. And we do, in terms of the basket of indicators, we do accept contextual information. If a student wants to tell us about some, you know, serious issues they have at home or some real specific circumstances, we get as much information as we can and we take it all into account. So it isn't as black and white as it looked on that slide. There is a number of other things that we'll consider as well, and that's part of the benefit of working with the school contacts, because they've got that knowledge about the students. And it's really helpful for us when we get a form where a teacher's filled in lots of information like that and says, this student is dealing with this X, Y, and Z, but they come to school and they told me that they're passionate about medicine and that kind of thing. So that obviously will, you know, sort of make us think twice when we see an application form if we've got that kind of detail as well.
Excellent. Thank you, Amy. Well, I think that brings us exactly up to time. So can I just say thank you again to Amy and to Julia for some really excellent presentations. Thank you.